Welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminded to sign up to our weekly email through Substack that you can get at readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a weekly write-up of our class along with all of the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Perhaps the most ambitious fundraising campaign in all of Jewish history was assembling the funds and materials necessary to build the Mishkan. Everyone was required to give a little bit. Even after the basic contributions that everyone was required to give, the Jewish people were encouraged to give even more. We've all been there. Matching funds, we need your support, anything you can do helps. But then something happened that may never again be repeated in the history of fundraising. Moshe begged the Jewish people to stop giving. In Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Hey, Vayomru al Moshe Lemor, Marbim Ha'am Lahavi, Midei Ha'avoda Lemalacha Asher Tziva Hashem Lasos Osam. They said to Moshe, the people are bringing more than is needed for the task. We have enough. We don't need any more donations. Adding to the strangeness, a fundraising campaign that stops because they have too much money. When has that ever happened? Is actually the way the Torah describes it at the end. V'hamalacha ha'isadayam l'chal hamalacha lasos osam. The Hoser. Their efforts, the Pusik says, were enough. Dayam, that's just enough. And also left them with extra. The Hoser. Well, which one is it? Did they actually have exactly what they needed, or did they have too much? Did they reach their goals, or is this the bonus round? My dearest friend, Rabbi Dr. Simcha Willig, shared a fascinating Or HaChaim with me many years ago. The Or HaChaim resolves this contradiction. Did they donate too much or just enough? By suggesting that Hashem made a miracle. The miracle, the Or HaChaim explains, was that everything that each person brought, even if it seemed extra, was incorporated into the building of the Mishkan. So even though they had extra, it was also just enough. What exactly was the point of this miracle? Why not just collect whatever is necessary and return or not accept whatever was extra? So to understand all this, let's explore the absolutely fascinating history of Jewish charitable work, specifically the development of our favorite friend, the Tzedakah Box, also known as a Pushka. One of the most incredible scholars of Jewish history today is Professor Shaul Stampfer. If you've never heard of him, it's worth exploring his books and scholarship. He wrote an incredible book called Lithuanian Yeshivas of the 19th Century, Creating a Tradition of Learning, which explores the early development of the yeshiva world. It is simply a must read. His other English book, both translated from the original Hebrew, is called Families, Rabbis, and Education, Traditional Jewish Society in 19th Century Eastern Europe. And it's a fascinating window into the social dynamics of the Jewish community in Eastern Europe. It is from his chapter in that book, The Pushka and Its Development, that nearly all of this essay is based upon. Before we explore the development of the Pushka, allow me to share a personal story about Professor Stampfer. In around 2010, I visited Portland for my first ever scholar in residence gift. It was like my first time ever. I was actually still single and I was very nervous. I put a lot of effort into my presentations. I was there for Shavuos, I believe. A few weeks later, I received an email from none other than Professor Stampfer. He was actually visiting Portland after Shavuos. He grew up there. His father was a rabbi in that community, and I think he was visiting his family. And he wrote to me to say that he was stopping by in the shul where I serve the scholar in residence and saw one of my source sheets lying around, and he really enjoyed them. I was young and looking for guidance. I had already known who Professor Stampfer was, but the fact that this world-renowned professor who was stopping off in a town visiting his family, stopped off in shul, picked up a source sheet, enjoyed it, and then took the time to find my email and email me. We didn't meet. He wasn't there when I was there for Shavuos. And email me a kind word to someone he had never met and didn't know is an act of kindness. It doesn't speak volumes about the quality of my source sheets. What it's really about is that it speaks volumes to his character and kindness. This is not just a scholar. This is somebody who is really a Baal Chesed, who is kind and understands communal sensitivities at the very highest level. He is not just a scholar. He he's an extraordinary person. But let's for a moment talk about his scholarship on the development of the pushka. A pushka, from the Polish word puszka, I'm not pronouncing that correctly, of course not, meaning box, is actually a fairly recent invention. These small boxes with a little slit on top to insert a coin were popularized in the 19th century. That's the 1800s. Earlier methods of charitable giving relied upon communal taxation, meal assistance, selling aliyot, that's an old one, and house-to-house collections. You have a mashulach, a collector, come to your door, nearly all of which, with the exception of taxation, are still in use today. Taxation ended. You can read our earlier shiur that we spoke about Mendelssohn and his role in that. But all of these involve some measure of publicity. People would find out about the donation. You buy an aliyah in shul, people hear, you give, you get a little bit of covet, you get a little bit of honor. The pushka, however, kept the size of the donation and even the donor's identity much more anonymous. Normally, when people went door to door to collect money, they would only visit the wealthy. One of the most important contributions of the pushka was that it allowed the poor to participate in charity as well. A family could make small donations into their home tzedakah box, and eventually, an emissary from that organization that distributed the boxes would come to the home to collect the pushka once it was filled, and they would come to the houses, not only of the wealthy, but every poor home that gave a couple coins every week. Aside from the poor, there was another demographic that the pushka served, namely women. Women, writes Professor Stampfer, were the secret to the success of the pushka. Most women went to shul infrequently, Shabbos and Yontif at most, and the home pushka opened up charitable opportunities within the home. Women composed special prayers to recite before putting money into the pushka. One moving prayer recorded in Shas Techina, which is a collection of these informal prayers, said as follows: Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the World, just as the pushka is made so that no one knows what is inside except for the collector who opens it and takes out the money, so the heart of a person is hidden. No one knows what another person thinks. More than anything else, what really accelerated the adoption of the pushka was increased relations between the Jews of Europe and the emerging Jewish community in Israel. Eastern European immigration to Israel began picking up in the late 18th century. The first wave of Hasidim came in 1765, and then a wave of the students of the Vilna Gaon in 1808. Much of the early struggles in fundraising parallel issues we still see today. There were concerns that money raised for the Jewish communities in Israel were instead being used to support other local causes. When have you heard that before? You've always worried. You see a big online campaign, you're like, is this really getting to where it's supposed to be? That's an old problem. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, known as the Baal HaTanya and the first Rebbe of Chabad, actually signed a letter prohibiting fundraising for Israel to be used for local causes. Rav Shneur Zalman's steadfast support for the Jews of Israel was actually one of the many accusations hurled against him that eventually had him arrested as a traitor to the government. Another familiar fundraising issue was turf wars between fundraisers. We've heard that before. Hasidim and Misnagdim, aside from their roiling ideological battles, also fought over fundraising territories. These still exist today. It's not between Hasidim and Misnagdim, but between different organizations or different departments in one organization. In 1812, a tentative agreement was reached between Hasidic and Misnagdic fundraising, dividing the territories of Eastern Europe. Rev Yisrael Mishklov, one of the prize students of the Vilna Gaon, was actually one of the signatories. In 1813, Rav Dov Ber Schneerson, the second Rebbe of Chabad, known as the Mittler Rebbe, wrote a beautiful letter encouraging the use of the pushka at home. This is one of the very first references to the pushka, likely made soon after the innovation became popularized in Eastern Europe. I'll read a little bit of the original Hebrew in the letter, and of course we have the link in the email if you subscribe through Substack, but let me read some of the Hebrew. V'hu davar eitzav v'chachma ma'od hutav be'enai gam mitam v'yesod shorish inyan atzdaka shehi b'chol eis u'befrat be'eis ha'ochel baboker u'be'erev mi Yachi Yasader Shulchano Shayitin Kol Ish Beveso Bepushka Hakavua Bekosel Samach L'Shulchano. What is he writing? The placement of pushka, says the Mittler Rebbe, is a very wise practice that is advisable in my eyes because of the reason and foundation for the commandment to give charity that we have at all times. Specifically, during breakfast and dinner, a person should give to a pushka that they have in their home next to their table a few coins or so before eating, and specifically because because the amount that is given into a pushka is hidden and the person who receives the money doesn't know who gave it and the person who gives it doesn't know who it is for, this really fulfills, says the Mittler Rebbe, the highest level of charity as outlined by the Rambam, which he famously discusses in Hilchos Matnis Aniyim. You can look in the 10th perek in the 7th halacha. He has the Shmona Milas Yesh Bitstaka Zula Mila Mizu. You can look that up over there in Hilchos Matnis Aniyim. Pushkas brought charity into the home. More and more institutions began to rely on them. The first yeshiva to distribute pushkas was Valozhin Yeshiva. One famous Polish writer described that in every Jewish home, there were two pushkas, one for Valozhin and one for the Jews of Yerushalayim. When other yeshivas saw the success of pushkas, again, same thing that we see today, they began to distribute them as well. You see one person, I don't know, do a marathon, do a dinner, do this, everybody else is on board. Not surprisingly, the administrators of the Valozhin Yeshiva did not take too kindly when they saw other yeshivas mimic their fundraising tactic. What do you think one organization does when they see another organization schedule their dinner on the same date or also do the same shtick or fundraising idea? They get upset. It's not okay. There was actually a Din Torah, a rabbinical court case, where leaders of Valozhin Yeshiva objected to the Mir Yeshiva distributing pushkas as well. The former claiming, meaning Valozhin Yeshiva, said it's Hasagas Gvul. You're infringing on our territory. The Beis Din decided, however, that every yeshiva had a right to distribute their own charity boxes. This is how eventually pushkas made their way to the United States in the latter half of the 19th century. The yeshivas would all send their pushkas to America to support their work. Like many fundraising methods we see even today, once a method is proven successful, everyone else jumps on board. Who doesn't remember the counters of old Queens pizza stores that were just like covered in pushkas from different organizations? The youngins don't remember this because so much of fundraising is done online now, and that introduces its own set of problems that we're not going to discuss today. Pushkas became so overwhelmingly common that in 1877, the Gadol Hadar, the leading rabbinic personality of his generation, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, the Rav Mikovna, the Kovna Rav, issued a decree that only organizations who had a long-standing tradition of collecting with pushkas could distribute their pushkas. There's a fascinating Hebrew work called the Chaluka that was published in 1912 by Rav Avraham Moshe Lunds, who collects many letters regarding fundraising disputes and proclamations related to the politics surrounding the pushka. Of course, we have a link to it. You could find it in our email through Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Even Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector eventually softened his view. Later on, he just insisted that if you place a pushka, you should receive prior approval from the established charities in Israel. In 1897, at the first Zionist Congress, the idea was suggested to establish a central fund which would allow for the purchase of land in Israel for the emerging Zionist movement. This eventually gave rise to the Jewish National Fund, which is known as JNF, and their ubiquitous blue boxes. Again, the youngins may not remember it, but if you're of a certain age, you absolutely know what I'm talking about. It took a while for the Zionist movement to fully embrace the use of the pushka, perhaps due to the fact that they had so long been associated with Eastern European yeshivas and pre-Zionist settlement in Israel. That's my own speculation. One rogue Galizianer, so it always takes one rogue Galizianer, the honor named Chaim Kleinman, made his own makeshift pushka, like literally did it on his own, to collect for the Jewish National Fund. Once others saw the success of the pushka for JNF, they became wildly popular. By 1939, almost 250,000 pushkas had been distributed for JNF. Professor Stamfer concludes his incredible article by calling attention once again to the primary force that really made the pushka what it is today: women. This is what he writes. The pushka was effective as a fundraising tool as long as it was integrated into a regular pattern of home ritual. By the integration of rituals involving the giving of charity by women, the pushka found its place in fundraising history. In retrospect, it would not be an exaggeration to claim that most of the land purchased by the Zionist movement was bought with donations of women. Similarly, and this is so beautiful, it was due to the devotion of women and not of men that the yeshivas of Eastern Europe continued to exist even when the rich had already turned their back on them. It was due to women donors that the Kol Olim in Eretz Yisrael survived and even flourished. The institutions that were supported by pushkas in critical transitional years, writes Professor Stamfer, are still with us today. They survived because in critical years, they could rely on the donations of countless women week after week. Which brings us back to our Parsha. Why, the Or HaChaim asks, did Hashem make a miracle that even what was extra, husar, it's extra, we don't need it, and not needed for the building of the Mishkan, was still incorporated into the final structure as if it was absolutely necessary. Dayam. The Or HaChaim writes something beautiful. Let me read a few lines from it. V'ulai sheyishmu hakasuv chibas b'nei Yisrael b'enei hamakom, ki letzad sheheviu Yisrael yoser meishir hatzarek, chash Hashem l'kavod kol ish, God was sending a message to the Jewish people that each of their individual efforts were absolutely essential in the building of the Mishkan. Even when someone came with a few coins or jewelry that wasn't actually truly needed for the construction of the Mishkan, God wanted to show the Jewish people that all of their efforts were truly necessary and needed because each Jew is essential and our commitment is vital. No one wants to be told that they are not needed by the community. No one wants to be or feel superfluous. Like my dear friend, Rabbi Dr. Simcha Willig, always reminds me, when someone approaches you with a request, how can I help? No one wants to be turned away and feel unneeded and necessary. If someone comes with their little tricycle and say, is this needed? Is this something that I need? We'll find a way, and it's absolutely necessary. You respond, it's absolutely needed. Thank you so much for bringing this for me. And much like the revolution of the Pushka that democratized giving and through every small gift in the home literally supported yeshivas and the very building of the modern state of Israel, the Mishkan showed the Jewish people that there is no such thing as a superfluous Jew. Every donation was incorporated and every Jewish effort, no matter how big or how small, was received as an essential part of the building of the Mishkan. A reminder that every Jew counts. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly email through Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors, my dearest friend, Jana and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.